take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the continent to bring you the truth about cannabis and marijuana law reform.
I smoke pot and I like it a lot.
The Russ Melville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation. Now, here's your host, Radical Russ Melville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. Welcome to the show. It is Monday, December 1st, 2014, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. So glad you could join us today for the internet's best news and interviews show concerning the green rush of marijuana, the growing truth about cannabis, the continued spread of marijuana freedom from coast to coast and everywhere in between. We will be here for all of it, and we thank you for being here for these first 499 shows. That's right. Tomorrow is show number 500 of the Russ Melville Show. Really excited for tomorrow's show and this milestone, making it, 500 shows independent. Thanks to you and your support. Thanks to our sponsors. Please patronize our sponsors and make sure they know that you support the Russ Melville Show and independent marijuana media. And if you can, join up and become a VIP member of 420 Radio. That helps keep us on the air. You can visit 420radio.org/donate, make a one-time donation via PayPal, or sign up for a membership, get a recurring monthly donation. That helps us pay for the bandwidth, the rent, and all of the expenses necessary to travel to what's going to be this year, coming up in 2015, six Cannabis Cups in the United States: Denver, Seattle, Northern California, Southern California, Denver, and Michigan. We will be at all of them, and we are seeking out name sponsors. If you would like to have your name on our booth at six American Cannabis Cups and have us tell people there at the event about your product and service and let them know that you're a sponsor of the Russ Melville Show, we need to talk. You can get in touch with me through social media just about everywhere under Radical Russ. All right, let's talk about today's show. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is joining us at half past the hour for our regular cannabis Q&A. Dr. Mitch joins us every Monday to take your live questions on cannabis science, culture, history, and health. And today we're taking a look at a new study that shows that marijuana is an excellent treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder as well as Alzheimer's disease. So we'll ask Dr. Mitch about that when we get to the half past segment. Then in the Radical Rant, we have been looking through the transcripts of the prosecution, the grand jury evidence that was made public in the case of the killing of Michael Brown by Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. You won't believe how many times the prosecutors brought up marijuana in that prosecution to help paint Michael Brown as some sort of out of control, crazed man. Also, we'll talk to Dr. Mitch about the marijuana breath test. You may have heard that story percolating in the news, and a new way to end marijuana addiction being studied at Vanderbilt in Tennessee. So we'll talk to Dr. Mitch about these as well. Also on the show, we're going to go behind the headlines where my friends with New Approach Idaho are taking on America's most pot-hating state, the Gem State of Idaho, and my suggestions as to what they might try to do to break through in that deep red state. We've also got some drug war data mining. We're going to take a look at the evaporation, or the excretion, I should say, of marijuana and its metabolites in people in reference to this Ferguson case and some of the statements by the prosecutors to the grand jury there. We'll show what the science says about THC in the blood. But all that comes right after the 420 Radio News. The headlines are next. Stick around. It's the Russ Melville Show.
Russ Melville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
420 Radio, freeing your mind 24 hours a day. Five of the last nine major party candidates to run for president, three of the last nine vice presidential candidates, and the last three two-term presidents have all smoked pot. Marijuana, the gateway drug to the White House. This is the Russ Belville Show. Free Weed from Danny Danko, replaying Wednesdays at 1 Pacific on 420radio.org.
Hey, this is Willie Nelson, or Norman. And I smoke pot and I like it a lot. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer than alcohol. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting those who smoke marijuana responsibly. To learn what you can do to help, contact Normal at NORML.org or call toll-free 888-67-NORMAL.
It's time for the 420 Radio News, covering the latest headlines in consumer cannabis, medical marijuana, and industrial hemp. Transcripts of 420 Radio News are available daily on our website at 420radio.org. Now, here's Russ Belville with your marijuana headlines in 4 minutes and 20 seconds. This is your 420 Radio News for Monday, December 1st, 2014. Legal pot in the U.S. may be undercutting Mexican marijuana. 2 or 3 years ago, a kilogram of marijuana was worth $60 to $90, says Nabor, a 24-year-old pot grower in the northwestern Mexican state of Sinaloa. Quote, but now they're paying us $30 to $40 a kilo. It's a big difference. If the U.S. continues to legalize pot, they'll run us into the ground, end quote. 2 years ago, the Mexican Institute of Competitiveness, in a study entitled If Our Neighbors Legalize, predicted the drug cartels would see their cannabis profits plummet 22 to 30% if the United States continued to decriminalize marijuana. Quote, this is dangerous work to cultivate it and sell it. If the army comes, you'll have to run or they'll grab you, Nabor explains. The day we get $20 a kilo, it will get to the point where we just won't plant marijuana anymore, end quote. Uruguay's national marijuana program is safe after a runoff election. Tabaré Vázquez's victory in Uruguay's presidential election is a show of support for the leftist coalition that has governed the country for the past decade and allows the government to proceed with its plan to create the world's first state-run marijuana marketplace. Vázquez, a 74-year-old oncologist who was president from 2005 to 2010, topped center-right rival Luis Lacalle Pou of the National Party 53% to 40% in Sunday's vote. The runoff vote drew international attention after Lacalle Pou promised to undo much of the pioneering plan to put the government in charge of regulating the production, nationwide distribution, and sale of Uruguay marijuana. Vázquez, meanwhile, said he would proceed with it unless it produced negative results. In the first round of voting in October, Vázquez fell just short of an outright victory, getting 48% support against 31% for Lacalle Pou. A Virginia state senator has introduced a bill to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana. Under the proposal, the possession of less than an ounce of marijuana would be decriminalized. Currently, that's punishable by a $500 fine and 30 days in jail. Among other things, the bill also would reduce the criminal penalties for distribution and possession with the intent to distribute by creating a presumption that a person who grows no more than 6 plants would be raising them for personal use. The bill would also soften some laws concerning marijuana paraphernalia and limit the forfeiture of property from the sale or distribution of 1 pound or more of marijuana. Currently, there is no minimum amount. Virginia State Police figures show that in 2013, there were more than 24,000 marijuana arrests in the state. After her research team secured preliminary approval this week for a $2 million grant from the state of Colorado to study how marijuana affects veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, a Metro Phoenix doctor says she no longer needs an Arizona university to house the study. Dr. Sue Sisley was ousted from her University of Arizona position earlier this year for what she believes were political reasons after she clashed with state lawmakers over medical marijuana research. Northern Arizona University refused to hire her, and Arizona State University has not said whether it will offer a position. Sisley wants to keep her part of the research project in Arizona because she said she's committed to local veterans suffering PTSD. She said a private donor has offered her a free lab space in North Scottsdale, and she may seek an academic appointment at an out-of-state university while conducting the research in Arizona. 6 months after Governor Mark Dayton signed a bill legalizing medical marijuana extracts in Minnesota, makers are poised to start growing. State officials on Monday announced the two companies that will grow, process, and sell medical cannabis to Minnesotans next year under the state's new law. Leafline Labs and Minnesota Medical Solutions were chosen from among 12 applicants. They'll distribute the medication through 8 sites across the state, the Minnesota Health Department said. State officials hope to have the products ready for sale by July. Minnesota Medical Solutions said its cannabis greenhouse in Otsego will be up and running this week. Lawmakers passed the strictest medical marijuana law in the country earlier this year. It prohibits smoking of the drug and requires instead that it be manufactured in pill or oil form. Medical marijuana will only be available to patients suffering from about 10 conditions, including ALS and cancer. This has been your 420 Radio News for Monday, December 1st, 2014. I'm Russ Belville. 420 Radio, your ticket to Seattle Hemp Fest.
There's so much I worry about as a mom. Stephen Harper thinks that organized crime should continue to profit from marijuana prohibition. Imagine regulating marijuana like alcohol and cigarettes with a strong and clear educational message, making it more difficult for my kids and your kids to access. Drug dealers don't ask for ID. Stephen Harper does not have the kind of judgment we need to protect our children, authorized by the Normal Women's Alliance of Canada.
Normal stands for Responsible Adult Cannabis Use. If cannabis use is causing problems in your life, consider taking a break or seeking medical assistance. Consider ceasing cannabis use if you have a family history of mental illness. Don't drive or operate heavy machinery while impaired by cannabis use. Cannabis use is not without risks, even though the risks are far less than those posed by legal drugs.
What's to keep somebody from getting all potted up on weed and then getting behind the wheel?
The Russ Belville Show reminds you to never smoke and drive impaired. Hang out for a while. Share.
Welcome back, everyone. 13 after the hour, and today we took a look at New Approach Idaho, which takes on legalizing in an ultra-conservative state. You may have seen the headlines that there is a New Approach Idaho, and with medical marijuana legal in Canada, Nevada, and Montana, and recreational marijuana legal in Oregon and Washington, the state of Idaho is one of 3 western states, along with Wyoming and Utah, which have staunchly resisted the growing support for marijuana's legality. Now, a new group is adopting the framing tactics of successful legalization campaigns from New Approach Oregon and New Approach Washington by calling themselves New Approach Idaho. The group's first Facebook post dates back to July 19th, but only now are the media beginning to report on their activities. The state's largest newspaper, the Idaho Statesman, reports that, quote, New Approach Idaho is focused on allowing medical marijuana, but the long-term goal is full legalization, end quote. The group consists of some former members of Compassionate Idaho, which lacked enough signatures to get medical marijuana on the ballot in the last election, and Moms for Marijuana International, which tried and failed in 2013 with medical marijuana. The group faces a steep climb in getting Idahoans to recognize the futility of marijuana prohibition and the wisdom of taxing and regulating marijuana instead. The state has the second largest Mormon population in the country, with almost a quarter of Idahoans belonging to the Church of Latter-day Saints, according to a February Gallup poll. However, Mormons are overrepresented in the state legislature, comprising more than a third of all lawmakers. The legislature is reliably supermajority Republican and regularly competes with Utah and Wyoming for the title of most Republican state legislature in the United States. Chuck Winder, a Presbyterian, by the way, is a Republican state senator and the sponsor of a 2013 marijuana resolution approved by a 29-5 vote by the Idaho State Senate. In the resolution, Winder explained that, quote, "National pro-marijuana organizations have invested millions to push drug legalization in America and have targeted Idaho for a medical," with sarcasm quotes, medical marijuana initiative. And he continues to say that legalization has led to, quote, "social and economic and legal chaos," and that, quote, "drug legalization laws in neighboring states have already adversely impacted Idaho through cultural acceptance of drug use that reduces the perception of harm among children and increases drug use," end quote. The resolution vowed that the state is opposed, quote, "to efforts to legalize marijuana for any purpose," end quote. And this passed 29-5. Now remember, marijuana is already quite illegal for any purpose in Idaho already. Idaho, in fact, is one of the three states, including Wyoming and New Jersey, that offer a misdemeanor jail sentence for merely being high in public, even without marijuana possession. You can get 6 months for merely being high in public. In Idaho, you can do 3 months in jail for merely being someplace where marijuana is stored, even if you never saw it, even if you never knew it was there. So that resolution was 29 state senators going out of their way to insist that it remains that way. However, the people of Idaho may not be so diametrically opposed to marijuana use for any purpose. A 2010 poll found that 74% of Idahoans would support medical marijuana use by terminally ill or seriously ill patients. Many of those Idahoans sought out medical marijuana in Oregon. Some, like me and about a dozen other Idahoans I know, left the state of their birth and their families, left them all behind to move to Oregon or to Washington to continue medical marijuana treatments for themselves or for their loved ones. Others made use of the fact that Oregon is the only medical marijuana state that grants medical marijuana cards to out-of-state residents. So folks would travel to Ontario, Oregon, a town on the Idaho-Oregon border just 50 miles from Boise, for their medical marijuana. Bill Espenson, a friend of mine who I used to play music with in Idaho, was the owner-operator of the 45th Parallel, a dispensary in Ontario that used to service those Idaho medical marijuana refugees. They were legal patients, and so long as they possessed and used their medicine while in Oregon, they remained within the law. But of course, some did not and returned to Idaho with their medicine, only to be busted by the Idaho State Police focusing on that 50-mile stretch of Interstate 84 leading from Ontario to Boise. Somehow, there always seemed to be far more people with broken taillights, expired tags, or minor traffic infractions going eastbound on I-84 than westbound. Espenson was busted by Oregon cops who secured authentic driver's licenses with fake names, used them and faked medical records to get authentic medical marijuana recommendations, and used those to get authentic medical marijuana cards. Espenson's dispensary checked all the IDs and cards, having no way of knowing the police were using fakes, and then traded the medical marijuana for a suggested reimbursement for supplies and utilities, all perfectly legal under the medical marijuana law. But the prosecutor instead painted that as sales instead of reimbursements, and Espenson was convicted of felonies. While Espenson's trial was ongoing, Oregon passed legislation that explicitly made legal all his activities, and legal dispensaries that operated just like his began operating, and while he sat for over 4 months in a prison cell. Well, now Bill Espenson is one of the leaders of New Approach Idaho, telling the Idaho Statesman that Idahoans suffering from medical ailments shouldn't have to worry about being arrested for possession. Espenson said, quote, "If we regulate it, then much of it will be off the streets. Prohibition has failed," end quote. Good luck, Bill Espenson, Sarah Frank, and all the folks from New Approach Idaho. You're going to need it. That and a whole lot of money. So, folks, if you can help them out, look up New Approach Idaho on Facebook, like their page, share it with friends, and let's kick that red state into the green, shall we?
Well, excuse me!
All right, Steve Martin, that's an old clip. Time to take a break. It's 20 after. That means it's 4:20 in Denver, Colorado. Hope they're enjoying a legal buzz. And wherever you might be, I hope your 420 is a thankful and wonderful one. We're back with some drug war data mining on THC in the blood when we come back. Radio, your ticket to the High Times Cannabis Cups. Get .buzz. .buzz is the internet platform that fuels community interest, excitement, and new experiences. .buzz is the premier online destination for internet users seeking the latest news on a variety of topics. .buzz appeals to groups active in blogging, communications, journalism, advertising, and marketing. .buzz offers registrants a stronger alternative to the shrinking namespace of existing top-level domain names, such as .com, .net, and .org. Get your name now at get.buzz. Green Stream Radio, replaying Tuesdays at 11 Pacific on 420radio.org. Hey, tokers and tokettes, Radical Russ here for the Canador, a practical solution to keep herbs from drying. The Canador is the perfect airtight storage system for your fine herbs, from the half-inch thick walnut and cherry wood construction, clear-top perforated jars for storage, and the humidity bead system that keeps your herbs at a perfect 65% relative humidity. I keep all my herbs in the Canador, and you should too. Check out Canador.com for more information. Arguing for the end of adult marijuana prohibition is easy because we have facts, science, reason, compassion, evidence, truth, and logic on our side. It is even easier when researchers catalog it all for us. Learn how to gather the facts on marijuana use, arrests, seizures, rehabs, drug tests, and more in this edition of Drug War Data Mining. Welcome back, everybody. 22 and a half after the hour, and today in the Drug War Data Mining, we're taking a look at a study on PubMed. And again, if you haven't seen our Drug War Data Mine for a while, you might have missed the link. It's pubmed.gov, PubMed.gov, and it's got a little search feature, or you can visit our chat room where we've got this link to the study already put in. This is a study by Karshner, Dr. Karshner et al., which means a bunch of other folks. And the study is entitled, "Do Delta-9 Tetrahydrocannabinol Concentrations Indicate Recent Use in Chronic Cannabis Users?" And the idea here was to try to determine if someone went without cannabis, how long, you know, if they went without a week or so, where would their THC readings be? Before we get too far into this, let's make sure everyone understands that what we're talking about in this study are active THC concentrations in the blood. So if you know about pee tests for work and they're testing your urine for metabolites, this ain't that. Metabolites, as we all know, can last for days, even weeks in a frequent user, but this is active THC we're talking about, which doesn't last as long. But as you'll see from the data in the study, it's also quite unpredictable and makes it almost impossible for us to come up with any way of measuring the blood to tell how high someone is. In this study, they got 25 frequent long-term cannabis users. They put them into a secure research unit at the National Institute of Drug Abuse under constant surveillance, so we would know for sure that they absolutely were not using cannabis while they were in there. And what they found, you know, they had 9 chronic users with no measurable THC over the 7 days of abstinence, 16 with at least one positive THC, but not necessarily on the first day. And one thing that I found very important, especially given what we'll be talking about in the radical rant later on today in the show, body mass index did not correlate well with time until last THC positive specimen. What that means is how fat you are didn't seem to matter as far as how fast or slow you metabolize THC in the blood. So a lot of these speculations by the prosecution in the Ferguson case about Michael Brown being a large man and how much cannabis he had in his system, therefore meant he must have smoked a whole lot of weed, doesn't really play out based on this data. Some people who could smoke a lot of weed might have a low concentration. Some people who smoke a little weed might have a great concentration. We find this later on in the study, where they got the cannabis users, they recruited them by just ads, basically, and they measured them when they went in, when they were admitted to the unit, and at 9 a.m. every day for the next 7 days. And they calculated their body mass index and so forth. And what they found was this, that 9 chronic users, 9 out of 25, had no THC positives in the 7 days that they weren't using. 14 were positive when they went in. And on the 7th day, 6 full days after entering the unit, 6 participants had measurable THC in their system. So 9 people didn't test positive at all. 6 people tested positive even after a week of not using any marijuana. And this is some information that we can find on a table that was provided, that, and they just label all the participants A, B, C, D, E, F, G, basically. You can see, for example, an African-American male with a 30.5 BMI, that's a pretty pudgy dude, smokes 2 blunts a day and turns up positive almost every day except the 5th and the 7th day. But another African-American, a skinny dude, 21.6 BMI, tests positive almost every day as well, just about the same as the fat guy. Scrolling down further, we find an African-American who claims to smoke an ounce a day. 30-year-old African-American claims to smoke an ounce a day, 25 BMI, so he's about, you know, regular-sized dude, right? But he doesn't test positive at all from day 2 through day 7. Then looking at some of the women at 31, 32, and 39 BMI who smoke anywhere from 8 to 10 blunts a day, one of them's testing negative all the days. Another one's testing positive every day. There is just no correlation when it comes to the blood and how high someone is. In fact, they found that some people, 3 of these people, the diamonds represent their positive test, tested negative and then positive, negative and then positive throughout the study.
420 Radio, turning red states and blue states green. Are you a hypocrite? If you live a closeted cannabis lifestyle, you are. Read about 7 people living a closeted cannabis lifestyle who are on the verge of coming out in The Hypocrites by Mara K. Eaton. Available at areyouahypocrite.net. You can purchase the book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, also available on iTunes. Check out Mara K. Eaton on Facebook as well. Learn more at areyouahypocrite.net.
Tokers, there's no good reason to get your dog stoned. While it might not harm them physically, imagine being a dog who already begs for treats all day, and then imagine that dog having the munchies. Not cool.
Growing plants indoors can be a rewarding hobby, but electricity bills can go through the roof. Then you have to cool down all those big hot lights. It can drive a grower insane. With Lush LED lighting, you can solve many of these issues and double your rewards. Matt and his scientists have developed the perfect light for flowering plants with far less cost and heat. And the results? Very effective. Check out LushLEDLighting.com right now and tell them Radical Russ sent you.
It's time for the Russ Belville Show's Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Earlywine is a professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and a leading author and researcher on cannabinoids and health, who pens the Ask Dr. Mitch column for High Times magazine. Get your questions ready in our live chat or call in to 971-533-7111 now.
Welcome back, everyone. 29 after the hour, and we've got Dr. Mitch on the line. How you doing, Dr. Mitch?
Okay. Okie dokie.
Glad to have you here, sir. Remind everyone, if you got a question, get it into our chat room. We'll ask it as soon as we can. Or you can call in live at 971-533-7111. We always like to start by giving Dr. Mitch the first word to tell us the latest in cannabis science. So what's up, Dr. Mitch?
Oh, a couple, three studies, as you mentioned. Some coverage from a study back in September about marijuana fighting Alzheimer's disease. I'm happy to elaborate on. Then we've got the work on the marijuana breath test, and then kind of misreported Vanderbilt study suggesting ways to end marijuana addiction that goes a little bit beyond the data. Any of those strike your fancy?
Yeah, the breath test one, that's happening up at Washington State University in eastern Washington. Quite interested in that, because what we've always heard is that, you know, there's no real good way of detecting whether or not someone's impaired. Is this a situation where if they build the detector, they're just going to set a number so the detector will work?
Sad but true, I'm afraid that is the case. And as I've mentioned in the past, I'd rather see some kind of roadside sobriety, you know, ride the unicycle, juggle, whatever, something that can show that people are competent to drive rather than that they have some certain number of nanograms per milliliter of blood, because, as we know, daily users can develop a lot of tolerance, and in truth, medical users absolutely have to be above that 5 nanograms per milliliter in order to get, you know, some of the medicinal effects they need. So I feel like this is a step in the wrong direction. I always admire, you know, people's technological abilities, but I just don't think that this is going to help with what we really need.
Yeah, and what I'm reading on this, they talk about, you know, first marketing it to states that have zero tolerance, where just the detection is enough, and then we can say, hey, now we can bust somebody with that. My thought is that once they have a detector, the next states that want to pass legalization will say, well, since we have a detector, let's make use of it. What differences, if any, are there with them trying to detect out of, you know, our breath rather than urine or blood? And specifically with respect to how long would that test be valid? I mean, would this be an argument that, hey, at least it's detecting recent use rather than 2 weeks ago?
I mean, with the alcohol world as kind of our guide, it would definitely be better than a urine screen, or potentially better than a blood sample. But I again, you know, I've never been a fan of those zero tolerance laws. I feel like depending upon the reliability of any machine to get a zero is a completely ridiculous proposal. And it really doesn't go very with what we care about, which is impaired driving.
Right. And all right. Well, we'll keep people focused on this breath thing as it continues on. Now, let's talk about that Vanderbilt study. You said it was a bit misreported. Explain why.
And the bottom line here is they're framing this as, hey, we've got a way to combat marijuana addiction. Now, I mean, whether you think marijuana addiction is a serious problem is a whole separate study. But as you read along, basically what they've done is genetically modify these mice so that they produce more 2-AG. And 2-AG is this endogenous cannabinoid, one that's in your body all the time anyway. And then they say, well, based on that, we see that those mice end up looking kind of anxious, and so therefore, if we could fix the TAG molecule, then they'd be less anxious, they'd be less likely to smoke pot, and then we could battle marijuana addiction. I mean, it's literally four steps downstream. I love that we can alter mice to have them produce more 2-AG and find out more about the endocannabinoid system, but that's independent of any kind of weird clinical implications for an imaginary marijuana addiction.
Mm. You bring up 2-AG, and that dovetails perfectly into a question from our chat room. Brian wanted to know, what are the endogenous cannabinoids? How many of them do we make, and what are they called?
So far, the ones that have the most literature on them are 2-AG and then anandamide, which is from the Sanskrit word for bliss, which is kind of telling. And both of those are pretty much direct agonists of the CB1 receptor, meaning that they get it to fire the way basically only an endogenous cannabinoid could. THC is really only a partial agonist. It doesn't really fire the same way. As it turns out, anandamide tends to decay rather rapidly, so it doesn't make the CB1 receptor fire as rapidly as THC does, but THC also doesn't seem to do it with the same kind of magnitude, if you will, with the same sort of big dramatic effect. And so I feel like it's not necessarily some divine plan that cannabis and humans co-evolve so much as, hey, we happen to find something out in nature that seems to resonate with a system we already had.
Excellent. All right. And we also, another question coming in from the chat room from Bob, wanted to know if you know anything about having a medical marijuana card and being on SSI, can they take your SSI away if you get a medical marijuana card?
It's really getting hairy, and it's different in different states, so I can't say, oh, here's how it is across the universe or anything like that. But at least, what a surprise, a couple of the southern states have decided that in order to get any kind of funding or state support, even unemployment and things like that, you have to pass a drug test, which I think is outrageously crazy and unfair and kind of implies that drug users are incapable of finding jobs, which we've got tons of data to suggest that's not the case at all.
But in a medical marijuana state, have you ever heard a case of someone losing their SSI? I know in Oregon, SSI is one of the ways you can prove that you get a reduced fee for the card. So I don't think they'd be taking it away here.
Yeah, at least trying to think through. I mean, now that they're 23, it's a little harder. I mean, I'm happy to have this problem, but it's a little harder to say for sure. I cannot recall someone emailing me about this or reading about it before. That doesn't mean it's never happened.
Yeah, I'm racking my brain, too. I don't recall anyone losing SSI. I've heard of, you know, veterans getting messed with their pain contracts at the VA. That's about as much as I've heard the government messing with individual users that way. But we could be wrong. If anyone knows, please let us know through the chat room or through email. Dr. Mitch, I had a question for you, which has to do with the intake of cannabis based on one's BMI. I'm doing a rant right after this segment about the whole Michael Brown case. And one of the toxicologists in the case testified that he had 12 nanograms of THC in his system. And that for a big guy like him to get to 12 nanograms, he had to have smoked a whole lot of marijuana as compared to like a 100-pound person would get to 12 nanograms pretty quick. Is there a body weight relationship to how high your nanograms per milliliter would be after you smoked pot?
No, as it turns out, that's a confusion with the alcohol literature. So
yeah.
Anytime you ingest something orally, anytime you're going to have the stomach and the liver involved, you really do have a body mass issue. So, if you and I drank four beers, it's way different from some 98-pound person drinking four beers, in part because the beer is only going to be distributed in lean body mass, and so they just don't have as much to spread it around. They do end up with higher blood alcohol concentrations. For THC, yeah, I mean, more leads to higher, but it's nowhere near the same because you're not going through the stomach. You're going from the lungs and then literally right in to the bloodstream, that, you know, the blood that goes right to the brain and heart, basically. So it's nowhere near the same kind of relation. So, in fact, this guy could have spiked above 12 nanograms after a couple of puffs. And, in fact, we have some urinary data, at least, to suggest that that's the case for people essentially uncorrected for weight. Regardless of weight, we would expect something like that. It would have implied that he'd been high relatively recently or that he was a regular user. But I want to emphasize, too, that cannabis doesn't increase aggression. Our laboratory data suggests decreases or has no impact.
Yeah, the terminology the toxicologist used in the transcript was a bigger receptacle. And he seemed to be arguing that even if you were smoking, since a 300-pound person has more blood, then if they both smoked the same amount, there'd be a dilution, more of a dilution in the larger person because they have more blood. But that seemed like ridiculous to me.
Well, we're talking about something that's psychoactive in nanograms, right? So literally, we're talking about some really subtle distinctions that probably have no implication for subjective effects or any kind of real level of behavior. So technically, yes, he's correct, but again, it's nowhere near parallel to the way alcohol works.
Okay. Yeah, and he did actually mention alcohol as an analogy, so I that was my first tip-off that, wait a minute, this guy, I don't know where he's going with this.
No, that's completely misleading.
Yeah, let's go to the Alzheimer's data. This is something that, you know, we uncovered earlier this year, back in September, I believe. But for folks that may not have caught that, what can we tell folks about the use of cannabis to treat Alzheimer's?
Just as I kind of make fun of folks for going too far from the data in the bad way, we can often go too far from data that are on our side, too. So there seems to be an interesting set of data now where basically THC is interfering with some of the processes that are related to Alzheimer's, particularly this amyloid beta, which is very common among folks with dementia when they're autopsied after death. This is a big thing to me because my mom is demented and I'm constantly poring over this literature. But the bottom line is this is we're still in the kind of petri dish stage here, and we don't want to just assume that, hey, if you smoke marijuana, you're not going to get Alzheimer's, because it's just not where the data are. I do think this is particularly promising. I like this Gary Wenk quotation, because he's the guy who's actually showed that there's neurogenesis that's related to cannabinoids and stuff like that. But we're many steps away from just, hey, give grandpa a toke and he's not going to be demented anymore.
Now, for the medical marijuana states that do recognize Alzheimer's as a treatable condition, that's mostly the agitation we're talking about, correct?
In fact, and appetite, and that weight loss is actually very good predictor of death and dementia. So you definitely want to make sure you try to maintain your body mass any way you can, and we have the legendary improved appetite with THC, and then they're markedly less agitated, and it actually looks pretty pleasant to them. So it's not like they're vegetable the way they are on some of the chemical straitjackets that you see from the prescription drug companies. They're just happier and less irritable.
All right. Well, Dr. Mitch, thank you so much for joining us on our Mondays. And from our audience, the folks heard about last week and they did want to offer their condolences to you and your family and your loss from last week. But we hope your holidays are getting better and brighter.
My enthusiastic thanks. Thanks so much.
All right. When we come back, folks, we'll have time for a little radical rant. Like I said, we're going to talk about Ferguson, Missouri, the toxicology, the reports from the Michael Brown case that went down there, and the news that's breaking lately about how much they concentrated on those toxicology reports with respect to the Michael Brown case. It's pretty... Oh, my God. You'll just have to wait for the rant. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Radical Rant is next.
Of the Marijuana Nation.
420 Radio. Tune in, turn on, get high, Lee Educated.
You know Herb Thrasher from the Herb Thrasher Flower Hour. Now get ready for Herb Age Designs for the proud cannabis consumer. Herb Age Designs. Lifestyle gear for the 420 friendly. Herb Age Designs. We've got frisbee golf discs and durable hemp gear. Herb Age Designs. We've got shot glasses, drinking glasses, coffee mugs, and beer cozies. Check us out on Facebook and online at herbagedesigns.com. And follow Herb Age and Herb Thrasher on Twitter.
In the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Russ Belville Show presents the anti-drug public service announcement of the day.
Maybe you heard just a little crack is okay. Maybe you heard cocaine can't really hurt you. Well, you heard wrong. There's no home run on cocaine. You get me? Are you listening? Just a little bit of crack or cocaine can be addictive or even kill you. That's the real truth. The lie is, it's the other guy who's going to die.
Cocaine, the big lie. Call 1-800-662-HELP. Furnished by Major League Baseball in cooperation with the U.S. Department.
This has been the anti-drug public service announcement of the day. To cure this sort of reefer madness, listen to the Russ Belville Show every weekday on 420radio.org.
When you are starting up a medical cannabis business, you want a fired-up lawyer who understands the needs of cannabis consumers. The Law Office of Lauren Vasquez is your fired-up lawyer for the cannabis industry. Visit her website, firedublawyer.com, or call 1-855-MMJ-LAWS for more information. That's 855-665-5297 for Lauren Vasquez, your Fired Up Lawyer, or email firedup.lawyer@gmail.com.
You can't handle the truth.
Entirely legitimate topic for debate.
You have offended my family.
Hey, this is great, man.
And you have offended a Shaolin temple.
One major responsibility is to encourage people to use less drugs.
I know nothing.
I support a change in law to end federal criminal penalties for possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
We don't need no stinking budget.
How in the century you have slurred the meaning of the words we, the people.
Be warned, this is not your mother's marijuana.
You could ask yourself a question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Conk?
I want to ask you a bunch of questions. I want to have them answered immediately.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Radical Rant.
Welcome back, folks. 45 after the hour, and of course, the country has been gripped by the protests over the failure to indict Officer Darren Wilson in the killing of unarmed black teenager Michael Brown. Protests sprung up. There's been fires and looting and riots, and the protests have also spread all across the country, some 175 cities getting involved in this. And regardless where you stand on the case, we definitely have to take a look at how it was prosecuted. And this prosecutor, Bob McCulloch in St. Louis County, did not do much of a job as a prosecutor. In fact, in his delivery of the information, the announcement last week, he sounded more like a defense attorney. Sounded like he was defending the cop. Unsurprising, as Bob McCulloch comes from a family of cops, and his dad was killed by a black man. His father, the cop, was killed by a black man. And in 22-year prosecutorial career, has never once indicted a police officer charged with violence or killing of a citizen. So it was kind of rigged from the get-go. But now, as we're able to dig into this grand jury testimony and evidence, as it was released to the public, again, something that's usually never done in a grand jury case, but it's been released to the public, and people have been poring over this testimony and discovered some pretty chilling information showing just how far these prosecutors went to make sure that Darren Wilson would not be indicted. If you missed the Lawrence O'Donnell show on MSNBC, the video is up on YouTube, and you'll find one big area of prosecutorial misconduct where the grand jury was told by the prosecutors that under Missouri law, the cops can shoot a fleeing felon. That's perfectly legal to shoot a fleeing felon. Cop doesn't have to feel that his life is in danger, doesn't have to be a self-defense thing, although he's got those rights as well to shoot someone who he feels is going to kill him. But they were told that a cop under Missouri law has the right to shoot a fleeing felon, and they believed that for the days and days and days that they listened to testimony and that they examined evidence that it's okay to shoot a fleeing felon. It's perfectly legal under Missouri law. And they listened to the cop testify about how big and black and scary Michael Brown was, and knowing while they were listening to this cop that it's perfectly okay to shoot a fleeing felon. And then on the last day of the grand jury, they said, forgot to tell you that 1985, the Supreme Court decided that the Missouri law that allows you to shoot a fleeing felon was unconstitutional. Oops, sorry, forgot to mention that. And not only did they just conveniently forget to mention that, as they had set this frame that it was legal to shoot a fleeing felon, not only did they forget to mention the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional almost 30 years ago, in telling the jury to forget about it, they didn't clearly tell them to forget about it. They said, oh, yeah, you know that thing we brought up about shooting a fleeing felon? Well, you know, it's not quite that way. It's different than that. But don't let that let you worry about that. They used a whole lot of pronouns and a whole lot of that's, so that even someone clearly understanding what's going on wouldn't, when you said that doesn't apply, did you mean the previous that or the current that? They made it as obscure as possible to make sure those grand jurors were still sitting there with the idea that a cop can shoot a fleeing felon. This is something they just conveniently forgot to update people, something that's been the law for 29 years. But that's not the main thing I want to focus on today when it comes to the killing of Michael Brown. Today I want to focus on how these prosecutors tried to blame Michael Brown's killing on dabs. That's right, marijuana concentrates. According to the released toxicology report, Michael Brown had 12 nanograms of active THC in his blood at the time of his killing. 12 nanograms. By all accounts, Michael Brown was about 6'5", weighed close to 300 pounds, and was a frequent marijuana smoker. Given that description, Michael Brown may have well awakened that morning with 12 nanograms in his system. You recall the Westwood Reporter? You remember that guy, William Breeze? A guy who's far smaller and skinnier than Michael Brown. Had his blood tested at 13.5 nanograms after a night's sleep and 15 hours of abstinence. But that didn't stop St. Louis County District Attorney Bob McCulloch's prosecutors from making a mountain of marijuana use out of a molehill of THC they found in his blood. According to the St. Louis County Chief Toxicologist, quote, "In a small person, like 100 pounds, to get to 12 nanograms wouldn't take a lot. A single joint could easily do that. But when you talk about a larger body mass, just like drinking alcohol, larger persons can drink more alcohol because they have the receptacle to hold it," end quote. No, I'm sorry, Mr. Toxicologist. Marijuana is nothing like alcohol in that respect. A large person who smokes a single joint can get high as hell if they have no tolerance to it. A small person like Coral Reefer could smoke you under the table because she has tolerance to it. She and I probably smoke the same amount of marijuana per day. And if you tested our blood, you'd probably find the same nanograms per milliliter. As we just heard from Dr. Mitch in the last segment, the size of your body has very little to do with how impaired you are by marijuana. But that implication was fed to the Ferguson grand jury, given the idea that, oh, a big fella like him, to get to 12, he must have smoked a whole lot of marijuana. You know, just like if he were drinking alcohol, he'd have to drink a 12-pack before he'd get drunk. But that's not the way it works. And the implication that he must have smoked a lot of marijuana to get to 12 nanograms is pretty damn specious. They got no clue on that grand jury that blood, marijuana, all of these terms flying at them are nowhere near like alcohol in blood. If you give me a 100-pound person and a 300-pound person with the same 0.15 BAC, I can guarantee both of them are too impaired to drive a car. If I know when they last drank, I can estimate how much they drank. If I know how much they drank, I can estimate how long ago they drank, because alcohol metabolizes at a fairly constant rate. But with marijuana, you can't make those estimates, period. I showed you the Karchner study with 25 people, different genders, varying body mass indexes, different amounts of marijuana they smoke, and there was no relationship between how much they smoke, how fat they were, how often they smoke, and whether or not they'd test positive. Marijuana metabolizes at different rates for different people. And frequent marijuana users, like Michael Brown, develop a tolerance to the impairing effects. Dr. Michael Bodden, he's that private pathologist who had the HBO show. He was hired by the Brown family for an independent autopsy, and he testified that the THC in Brown's blood was, quote, "a relative small amount, and how it affects somebody varies," end quote, and that, quote, most important, quote, it doesn't make people go crazy, end quote. Now, if you remember from this case, there was a famous video that was shot. It was shown on CNN. Somebody got it on their camera phone, right? The camera focuses on two construction workers who are just down the street from where Brown was shot. And they say, quote, he had his fucking hands up. That's what one of the men said in the video just shortly after Brown was shot. But when McCulloch's prosecutors interviewed those construction workers from the grand jury, they didn't concentrate on the he had his fucking hands up part. They didn't concentrate on what they told CNN that, quote, the cop didn't say get on the ground, he just kept shooting, end quote. They didn't concentrate on the two construction workers putting their hands up to imitate what Michael Brown had just done, what they had just seen him do. No, they didn't concentrate on that. Instead, they focused on the minutes before Officer Wilson arrived as Michael Brown and his friend Dorian Johnson passed the two construction workers on the street. In the testimony, one of the workers said they engaged in a small talk conversation about Jesus and anger management with Johnson and Brown when they noticed that Brown had a small amount of marijuana on him. One worker told Brown, quote, you ought to try this wax stuff, end quote. Referring, of course, to marijuana concentrates. That conversation was confirmed by Dorian Johnson, who denied that Brown had used any marijuana that day. Now, the detective who testified to the grand jury, the detective who interviewed the construction workers, told the grand jury he didn't know what wax was. But then, when the toxicology report came back with 12 nanograms of THC, he went to the medical examiner. And the medical examiner told the detective, and the detective told the grand jury, that 12 nanograms of THC, quote, could have potentially caused a loss in perception of space and time, and there was also the possibility that there could have been hallucinations, end quote. Despite Johnson saying they hadn't used marijuana, despite no marijuana being found on Brown or Johnson, despite the workers both saying they hadn't given any marijuana to Brown or Johnson, the detective told the grand jury he suspected the workers sold Brown some concentrate. Despite the evidence that seemed to show that Brown himself hadn't even heard of wax, McCulloch's prosecutor asked a police chemist, quote, if one were to ingest that, would you be consuming a higher level of THC than you would if you were to have smoked or ingested the plant material? End quote. And of course, got the truthful response of yes. Continuing that line of questioning, the prosecutors once again planted the seed that Brown's marijuana use turned him into a drug-fueled beast. Quote, but you cannot draw any conclusions that he was suffering or that he was experiencing hallucinations or having a psychotic break, end quote, to which the toxicologist replies this is correct. Well, what other terrible symptoms can we not be sure about when it comes to Michael Brown's unknown use of marijuana at some unspecified time in some unspecified amount, but we can still manage to mention to the grand jury and plant that in their heads? In the end, the grand jury failed to indict Officer Wilson. 12 people who very likely don't use marijuana or understand a thing about it were exposed to 44 separate instances of Brown's marijuana use being questioned. They're told 12 nanograms would require a lot of marijuana for a big fellow like Brown, and that a THC level that high could cause hallucinations and psychosis. They're given the implication that he may be a wax user and then frightened by the concept that this new scary drug is so much more potent than mere pot smoking. They've seen the video from the convenience store where Brown pushes a store clerk and steals cigarillos used for marijuana blunts. Then they hear 4 hours of testimony from Wilson explaining how big Michael Brown was, like Hulk Hogan, his face a demon, his body making a grunting-like aggravated sound and bulking up to run through the shots, end quote. In the end, they believed it all. Because, of course, cops who were given weeks to tell their story after seeing all the witness testimony and forensic evidence leaked to the press, why, they wouldn't change their narrative for retroactive continuity. For the grand jury, Officer Wilson had no choice but to gun down the unarmed, psychotic pothead in self-defense. That's all the time we got for hour one, but stay tuned for hour two, Toker Talk Radio. We'll take your calls at 971-533-7111. We've also got a few more stories to talk about in the news. President Obama says he wants to reduce police militarization, but he's not really doing much about it. And we'll go off the warpath. If you say something mean about someone on Facebook, when does that become a true threat, according to the First Amendment? For everyone here at 420 Radio, I'm Radical Russ. Until next time, take care of each other, Tokers.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com. You take a seat, you're